It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine technology transfer in psychedelic research and a race for pharmaceutical patents. A Wisconsin symposium highlights the latest studies and new challenges in the psychedelics industry. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Hudson is director of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances, professor at the UW School of Pharmacy. And David Casimir is a patent attorney, co-founder of the Madison-based nonprofit Porta Sophia, a library of information on psychedelic substances. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
You started Porta Sophia in 2020. What is the organization trying to solve?
We recognized that there was a problem related to patenting in the field of psychedelic medicine. And in particular, we were seeing the Patent Office grant a surprisingly large number of patents that we believe should not have been granted. And when we dug into that, we were realizing that they were not finding the information needed to prevent those patents from making it through the process. And so Porta Sophia was created to collect that information and make it readily available to the patent office and anyone else in the world who wants to see it.
The patent officials assemble what's known as prior art. Can you explain what prior art is?
Yeah, prior art is sort of the collection of publicly known information that exists before a particular patent application is filed. And for a patent to be granted, it has to be new and non-obvious in view of all of the prior art.
New and non-obvious. And so some psychedelics like psilocybin or magic mushrooms are grown naturally, been used for centuries by indigenous groups. How can a company patent a product like that?
In theory, they should not be able to patent a product that replicates what has been done in the past, what was in the prior art or out there in the public domain. And we've definitely seen various entities trying to patent such things. To obtain a real patent, some actual innovation would have to happen. So some new discovery on a new compound, or perhaps new ways to formulate it, but something that sort of requires lab work.
Paul, what is the environment like out there? How much demand exists for companies to create patents around psychedelic substances or therapies?
There is a perception that there's a lot of money to be made in this space and a lot of interest, of course, in psychedelic and psychoactive drugs. And we've seen a lot of investor money put into various startup companies that have been looking for a hook, if you will, to be able to set in a piece of intellectual property that they can commodify or commercialize. And it's proving difficult. There's been some contraction in the industry recently. And as David knows, there's a lot of competition for various aspects of how not only what the compound is that's being used, but how one might use it, what kind of environment it's being used in. So there's a lot of jostling for seats here.
You know, David, can you just step back for a moment and explain the importance of patents in what they do in the drug development process and what they could be protecting in the case of emerging psychedelics and this research area?
Sure. Yeah. So a patent is a government-granted right, and it effectively gives to an inventor a limited monopoly. And if someone gets a patent granted, they have the exclusive right for approximately 20 years to determine who gets to make, use, or sell a particular innovation. And so it's a powerful right because it effectively controls a market for a particular product or service for a 20-year period. So, please, I was going to say,
you interact with patent attorneys. You know, how much energy and, you know, what is it like in terms of patent attorneys focusing on psychedelic substances in this moment?
Well, and yeah, so patent attorneys are essentially hired by innovators, which could be universities or companies or individuals or investment groups, to file patent applications on their behalf. And what we've seen, especially in the last 3 to 4 years, is an exponential increase in the filing of patent applications related to psychedelics.
One patent that gained your attention was this mental health care company attempting to patent psilocybin to treat depression. What happened in that particular case?
Yeah, so in that particular case, a very broad patent application was filed. When you looked at the broadest coverage they were seeking, it was attempting to cover psilocybin to treat depression and included aspects of set and setting, which is effectively the environment in which the drug would be administered to a patient. And that patent caused a lot of uproar because it was claiming things that I think everyone in the field recognized were already known, things that were in the prior art.
What is the situation around that particular case now? Where does it stand?
So Porta Sophia, the organization I work with, not only creates this public library, but we also reach out directly to the patent offices around the world to inform them of this prior art and to try to prevent overly broad patents from being granted. And in this particular case, we filed a submission to the U.S. Patent Office identifying that what was being claimed in this patent was not novel. And the patent owner voluntarily changed their claims to make them substantially narrower after our submission.
David Casimir, patent attorney, co-founder of Porta Sophia, nonprofit library of information on psychedelic substances. Paul Hudson with us directs the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. You can join in with a question. Call in with your comments at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, when you see the patenting attempts in existing drugs like psilocybin, maybe LSD, ecstasy, does that have an effect on your research? Could that have a chilling effect on research communities?
It can. Typically, we are working with the companies that are making the product, and we are able to get the drug through typically either donations or increasingly having to pay for it. I'm not sure that it's a barrier if they're trying to make a patent at this point, but it does become more difficult to do the research when they are trying to protect their intellectual property and the university expects to have its own access to that same intellectual property. So there's a bit of a competition there about who has the rights to the science that is developed when we do these clinical studies.
Could corporate interests take the psychedelics field of research in a new direction?
I think that they are trying very much to do that because the new direction may be something that they can patent, maybe not the drug so much mm-hmm. as the use. And David would be able to comment on that better than I.
David, are companies attempting to patent psychedelic therapies in addition to psychedelic substances? What do you see?
Absolutely. I would say that's been one of the major strategies used by companies. For example, one of the patents that we saw early on that led us to want to form Porta Sophia was a group of investors out of Silicon Valley had filed and got granted a patent on the use of LSD to treat allergies. So the patent office allows you to patent use of known drugs for new indications. Although when it comes to psychedelics, it's, I think, hard to find a truly new indication.
That's interesting. And, you know, in terms of even the delivery of psychoactive substances and the environment in which the therapy would happen, are there patent attempts there as well?
There are. There was actually a fairly controversial patent granted by the patent office on the use of a vaping device for delivery of psychedelics.
And what happened there? What was the issue?
So the knowledge that vaping devices can be used with psychedelics is known in the prior art. Patent office did not identify that prior work and granted the patent. So that is still a patent sitting out there right now, potentially able to be enforced.
Mary from La Crosse called in. Mary says that they've experimented with psilocybin in chocolate bars in states where it is legal, and Mary says it had no effect on them. Paul, do some people not respond in anticipated ways?
Yes, that's correct. The doses, of course, are going to be important. Some people feel that microdosing is effective. There's no data that it is any better than placebo at this point for LSD and psilocybin. Studies need to be done to verify that. But even if one is looking for a more substantial psychedelic experience, of course, we don't know how much was in those chocolates. And I want to point out that even in the studies that we're seeing to be so encouraging for depression and substance use disorders, not everybody responds. And I think people need to realize that this is not a panacea, this is not a magic pill. One other thing that I'd like to point out is that that when we are looking at individuals that are taking this in a study, that there's a whole package, again, of preparation, presence, and integration debriefing afterwards. And somebody that just takes these chocolates at home should not necessarily expect to see the same therapeutic benefit as someone that's in a clinical study or hopefully in a therapeutic regimen once these things are approved by the FDA.
What are the delivery methods in therapeutic clinical trials that are underway?
Typically, we're using capsules of pure psilocybin. There are some companies that are putting an extract of mushrooms that is standardized to the psilocybin content. But in general, we're using pure psilocybin, not mushrooms. And for the MDMA, for the treatment of PTSD, those capsules are also pure drug.
Pharmacist Paul Hudson leads the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. Attorney David Casimir is a co-founder of Porta Sophia. That's a nonprofit library of information on psychedelic substances. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts on the emerging psychedelics therapy industry. What you wonder? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the therapeutic uses of psychedelic substances, clinical trials underway in Wisconsin, and concerns over the future of psychedelic drug patents. Call in at any point. Ask a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have David Casimir, a patent attorney, co-founder of the Madison-based nonprofit Porta Sophia. That's a library of information on psychedelic substances. Paul Hudson is director of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. Let's bring in Chandra in Ironwood, Michigan. Chandra, hi. What is your question?
Hi there. My name is Chandra. I'm wondering about ketamine therapy. I use ketamine therapy in the privacy of my own home through, I believe there's salt tabs, and for chronic anxiety and pain. And it was very successful, and I was able to get remission from debilitating anxiety. And I'm just wondering, through, you know, various research or PET imaging or, you know, whatever you guys have access to, what is the difference between ketamine therapy and its success rate versus psilocybin or LSD or, you know, ibogaine?
Chandra, thank you so much. Paul, go ahead.
But we really are not looking at ibogaine. Ibogaine's been used as a purported treatment for opioid detoxification or withdrawal support. In terms of comparing it against psilocybin or LSD, ketamine has not been compared head-to-head. A lot of people benefit from ketamine-assisted therapy, but as is the case with psilocybin and MDMA, we feel strongly that individuals who choose to go through ketamine-assisted therapy for depression or other maladies benefit most from incorporating that with a presence of a skilled therapist so that during the dose's effect, they can be counseled and worked with, as opposed to just taking the drug at home. Now, some people benefit from taking it at home, I'll grant you that, but we think that the benefits are greater if they have the therapist there with them.
Do you see in your research, Paul, more comparison type research to other medications like ketamine therapy when you are looking at the future of clinical trials?
Definitely. So the I think that for the psychedelics and MDMA to really move into the market, they're going to have to demonstrate that they are at least as good, if not better, than what we have currently. Now, for PTSD, we really don't have a lot of really good effective drug therapies, and we think that this is going to hold a lot of promise, and we're looking forward to the MDMA being approved by the FDA in the next year or so. With psilocybin, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to compare. We're probably going to be seeing that compared against some of our standard antidepressants, such as the Prozac class of drugs and such.
David, how might patenting a therapy or a substance like psychedelics affect the cost of the treatment in the long run?
So if someone's able to get patent granted and they're willing to enforce it, it can have a significant impact on pricing. When we look at sort of other pharmaceuticals, pricing typically is 50 to 80% higher on a patented drug versus a non-patented drug. But there are certainly examples out there where you can see tenfold or hundredfold increases. And you might expect, you know, I think more substantial increases in the psychedelic space because the existing known drugs are relatively well established and not too challenging to formulate.
Let's take another call. Jane in Lancaster. Jane, hi.
Good morning. My concern is the drug, drug interactions. These are drugs being developed by people who perhaps only eat food with them. What about the people who eat, who take multiple kinds of drugs? And what about the use of these at different ages? Certainly, some people could be more prone to having reactions, which I don't see how they can possibly understand the use and the power of this drug, considering how many people use it and how many different ways.
Jane, thank you. Paul, can you speak to contraindications there?
Now, there have not been many studies that have looked at individuals older than 65 for the treatment with psilocybin. So we do need to get some additional studies with older individuals. And I think that that's going to be the case with some of the upcoming studies. In terms of drug interactions, we don't really see a lot of likelihood that there are going to be drug interactions in terms of interfering with how the body gets rid of the drug. However, we do find that individuals who are already on an antidepressant, typically we feel need to be tapered off of that antidepressant before they can get the psilocybin because the antidepressant seems to block some of the activity of the psilocybin. So we don't really know the effects of all the drug interactions, but from a in general, we do not think that that's going to be a big problem. I think it's going to be more the other psychoactive drugs, the antidepressants, the anti-anxiety agents that they might be on, that we need to tease out yet.
David, when you look at the emerging substances, do patents legitimize psychedelic therapies?
Yeah, they do in a number of fronts. And I think there's in terms of drug accessibility to the public, there's a complicated interaction between patents and the FDA regulatory process and reimbursement systems by state and federal governments and insurance companies. You know, generally, a company that wants to go through the FDA process is going to try to get a patent because the patent helps them raise funds necessary to cover the very high costs of that process. So typically what you see coming through the FDA are oftentimes patented drugs rather than unpatented drugs. And essentially that limits public access through the FDA to those things that are patented, which may or may not be the best or least expensive options.
Patent attorney David Casimir with us, co-founder of Porta Sophia. That's a nonprofit library of information on psychedelic substances. Paul Hudson with us, director of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. Fielding your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. David, in January, Oregon legalized the use of hallucinogenic mushrooms. How will the decriminalization or the legalization of psychedelics, how will that affect therapies going forward?
It's a really interesting question, and it falls into that complicated issue I just raised, because there's the issue of sort of decriminalization, and then there's a separate issue of sort of legalization and sort of regulatory approval and payer approval. You can have something that might be legal, say the use of mushrooms to access psilocybin, but you might then also have a regime where any commercial uses of psilocybin from an FDA standpoint, might need to be going through pure psilocybin through particular clinics that are certified. And that may end up influencing essentially general accessibility. People will either have to use things at home, sort of legally in a decriminalized situation, but not in a clinically ideal situation, or go through the clinical route, which will be highly regulated and almost certainly more expensive.
And Paul, you see the clinical route as truly beneficial for potential patients.
Yes, but to come off of David's comment, home therapy may be possible, but I think that that's going to need to be incorporated with preparation and possibly that the therapists are there at the subject's home, as opposed to having to come into a clinic. So how we actually administer this, the setting, the preparation, and where we do that is still something we haven't optimized. We're going to get it across the finish line, I think, with the way that we're doing it now, but it's not necessarily the best way to do it or the most accessible way to do it.
Paul, in our last 30 seconds left, what advances in psychedelic research are you watching for next?
Well, we're getting a much better understanding of how the drug might be working from a biochemical standpoint. There are people that feel that it's a more spiritual experience, but we also are finding some really interesting things, including that we may not need the psychedelic experience at all to have some regeneration or some brain repair. And so David Olson at Davis, UC Davis, is doing some really great work about, and there's a lot of interest in non-psychedelic psychedelics.
We'll be watching that. Paul and David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Paul Hudson, professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, director of its Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. David Casimir, patent attorney, co-founder of Porta Sophia, that's a Madison-based nonprofit library of information on psychedelic substances. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.